Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me to give this talk. And I'm here today representing my program, the Program for Jewish Genetic Health. I also have one of my co-leaders here, a genetic counselor, Hani Weissman. So I'm going to start with the caveat that I have a PhD. I don't have an MD. I'm not a clinical person. So all of the clinical questions are going straight to Hani, who's sitting over there. And also, it's a great honor for me to be able to present with Rabbi Reichman. He was also my teacher, and now he's a colleague, and he's on the advisory board of our program. So the way that we're going to do this today is we are going to start with this handout, and I'm going to run through a very quick primer on BRCA to get everybody in the audience up to speed. And then after we go through page one of the handout, Rabbi Reichman and I are going to go back and forth, and we're going to discuss some of the issues in very brief detail, and then hopefully there'll be time for questions after that. So some of you may know about our program for Jewish genetic health because we do carrier screening at the premarital or preconception stage, and some of you in the audience may have used our program for that, and that's for diseases like Tay-Sachs, but that is not what we're going to be talking about today. So today we're going to be talking about testing for cancer risk in adults, and we're going to be focusing specifically on BRCA1 and BRCA2. The first point that I need to make is that everybody has BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Every person in this audience has those genes, and their normal function in the body is to protect people from developing cancer. When mutations or mistakes happen in those genes, that's when you start losing the protection, and people who have these mistakes or mutations are called carriers, and they're at increased risk to develop cancers. So let's just get everything straight. Never say that you have the BRCA1 or 2 gene if you're a carrier, and vice versa. Everyone has the genes, and then the ones that have mutations are called the carriers. So if you look at figure one here on the handout, what I'm showing you here is a family of BRCA carriers. Men and women can both be BRCA carriers, and those carriers have mutations in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. In the family that I'm showing you here in this diagram, what's being passed down from generation to generation is the increased susceptibility to develop cancer. So you need to understand here that it's not a guarantee. What you're passing down is not cancer itself, and you're not passing down the guarantee to develop cancer. What you're passing down is the increased susceptibility to develop cancer. So if you look at the figure, you'll see some of the carriers have developed cancer, and they're shaded, but there are other carriers who have not, for various reasons, developed the cancer. Those are open boxes, and some of them have died of those cancers. And again, you're passing down an increased susceptibility, but not a guarantee. So in figure two, I'm showing you what that increased susceptibility would look like for BRCA carriers. I'm choosing women to show here right now. So I'm showing you the increased susceptibility for BRCA carriers who are women to develop breast cancer, which is on the left, and then ovarian cancer, which is on the right. So you can see that there is a hugely increased risk to develop those kinds of cancers if you are a woman who's a BRCA carrier. But men can also be BRCA carriers. Men can also get breast cancer and other cancers related to BRCA, like prostate cancers, pancreatic cancers, melanoma, other cancer types. So it's very important to realize that men can be BRCA carriers, and also that men can pass that mutation down. So if you are a BRCA carrier, for each of your offspring, there's a 50% chance that they will also be BRCA carriers. So don't think that men are exempt from this. So the question is now, how do we find out if somebody is a BRCA carrier? And the answer is that we do that by genetic testing accompanied by genetic counseling. And this is done in an office, in a medical office, where someone would show up and would be talking to a genetic counselor and discussing the reasons to get tested and the pros and cons of getting tested, the limitations of the test, and what the options would be if you come back being a carrier. We call that being positive. So it's not positive in the good news kind of way. It's positive for being a carrier. And the way that the testing is done is that a sample from the individual is sent off to a testing lab, and the lab tests it, and then the results come back to the doctor or the genetic counselor, and that's reported back to the patient. In the Ashkenazi Jewish community, testing for BRCA is a little bit easier than in the general population because there are three mutations that are very common in the Ashkenazi population. I'm showing this to you in figure three here. So on the top of figure three, you could see the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that are shown as like rectangular figures. And then there are three common mutations, some of you may have heard of some of these, that are common in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. And it's easy to test for these because these are so common. So this is the first step that you would do. If you were testing someone who is Ashkenazi Jewish, you would start by looking at these three mutations. The theory is that the risk to be a carrier of one of these mutations, if you're Ashkenazi Jewish, is between 1 in 40 and 1 in 100. So there will be several people in this room and several families in this room that are BRCA carriers, because by virtue of the fact that you're Ashkenazi Jewish, although some of you may be Sephardic too, there's a 1 in 40 chance that you will be carrying one of these mutations. This number, 1 in 40, actually is much higher if somebody has had breast or ovarian cancer. So the number increases a lot in that case. And testing right now is recommended for people who have a personal history of the relevant cancer, so primarily breast, ovarian, pancreatic cancers. Testing is recommended for people who have a personal history of that, or also who have a family history of that. So the one thing that we're not going to talk about today is personal history. We're not going to really deal with people who have cancer or people who have had cancer, because as you can see from the title of today's Kolol Yom Rishon, it's about taking control. And when we talk about taking control, we really are talking about prevention. So we're going to be talking about people who need to be thinking about this by virtue of their family history. And when I say family, I mean people's immediate families, but also their extended families, and also the global Jewish family. So we need to think of families in different spheres right now. If people are tested for BRCA status and they come back that they are carriers, they have several different options, which we're going to talk about further in our back and forth, and I show you that in figure four. So there are options for the people who are carriers, and these are options that they can resort to reduce their risk of developing cancers by means of preventing developing those cancers. As Rabbi Fold said, there's also the ability to prevent transmission of the mutation to the next generation, and we'll go into that in more depth a little bit later. Also, it's very, very important for carriers to be able to tell their family members about their carrier status so that their family members can also be able to resort to those same options. So there are options. The mutations are known. It's very clear-cut. The prevalence rate is very high in the Jewish community. So for all these reasons, it's a really important thing to be thinking about, and it's great that YU and the Medical Ethics Society are thinking about this also. Is everyone with me on the background? I know I went through it pretty fast, but I hope it's clear, and obviously you can take your handout home and learn it more. I also left an infographic in the back of the room, which looks like this. I don't know if everyone has picked this up, but this goes into a lot of what I said in greater detail, and also links to a website that our program developed called brcacommunity.com, and on there you can really learn more about risks and options and testing and different ways to get tested. So pick this up on the way out. Okay, so now we're going to go to the back and forth part. So if you turn to the second page of your handout, or the back page, you can see the issues that we're going to go back and forth about. And we've never tried this model before. Actually, this is the first time that Rabbi Reichman and I are speaking together. But we've never tried this back and forth option or this model. Usually one speaker will speak about the medical part, and one speaker will then speak about the halachic and ethical part. But we're going to try to go back and forth, and we'll see if you like it. We figured it's better to cover topic by topic than to one person talk and then the next person talk. Okay, so the first issue that we're going to be discussing back and forth is genetic testing for BRCA, specifically for high-risk individuals. So the question is, what does high-risk mean? What do I mean when I say high-risk? So I mean two things. The first thing I mean is that there's already a mutation running in your family. That would put you in the category of high risk. So if your aunt has been tested and your aunt is a BRCA carrier and she tells you, I was tested, I'm a BRCA carrier, then your family is at high risk to have a mutation. So you could consider testing in that way. And the reason you'd want to get tested is if you're also a carrier, then you have all these options we discussed about, and you could resort to those options. So in that way, knowledge is power, and you'd want to know. But you also might want to get tested because if you're tested for those mutations that your aunt has, and then you do not have that mutation, it's actually a sense of relief that you do not carry the familial mutation. So that's where you'd want to get tested, and you'd be high risk if there's a mutation in your family. Another category of high risk are people that have a very strong family history of the relevant mutations. And this means that if you look at your family tree, your family is peppered with people who have cancers that are breast cancer, ovarian cancer, pancreatic, prostate, of these relevant cancers. And very often these mutations and these cancers occur at a very young age. So that would also be high risk if there's a lot of cancer in your family and if it happened at young ages. Right now, the guidelines in the medical community would say that if you belong to a family like this with a very strong family history, it's very likely that you should consider testing and that that testing would be covered by your health insurance. So that's good. So there are guidelines that support if you're Ashkenazi Jewish and if you have one, a first or second degree relative that has had the relevant kinds of cancers, you would meet criteria to get testing and your health insurance would probably cover it. So the problem is that what we're seeing now with our program is that, first of all, a lot of people do not classify themselves as high risk when they should be classifying themselves as high risk. So not a lot of people know that the criteria are very relaxed right now. There's a very low threshold for what would make you at high risk, and people do not think they're high risk, but many people are. The second problem we see is that even though somebody suspects or knows that they're at a high-risk state, they're not coming in to get tested because they're scared, and they don't want to have that knowledge. And the bottom line, I'm going to steal Chani's words for this, the bottom line is that if you're from a family with a strong family history, there's something going on in your family on the genetic level. It could be a BRCA1, it could be BRCA2, it could be other cancer genes. Those are not the be-all and end-all of hereditary cancer and these types of cancers, but if you have a strong family history, there's likely that something is going on. You don't really need a genetic test to tell you that there's something going on, but you could use a genetic test to help you manage yourself medically. So it's important to do it in that way. And I think that I will now turn the podium over to Eddie and let him talk about the genetic testing from the halachic and the ethical perspective.
Good morning, everybody. A pleasure, a schus, and an honor to be here. I want to thank Liat and the Yitzi for their extraordinary role, not only in today's events, but for their events throughout the year in continuing the torch of the Medical Ethics Society. And of course, thank Rabbi Fold for his continued support and his vision in guiding us as a Jewish community through some of the more complex issues of science and medicine in the 21st century. I just want to begin by giving us just a little bit of appreciation of how extraordinary these 2 hours are here this morning. And there's really no greater reflection of the mission of Yeshiva University than this session today. We've heard from Dr. Agus. Dr. Agus heads up the Program for Jewish Genetic Health at our medical school, Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University. It is an institute, it is a program which is literally on the cutting edge of one of the most exciting developments in the modern era, genetic testing, and in particular today, the breast cancer gene, which is just one small piece of a very complex process of genetic testing. We will hear, after our session, we will hear from Rabbi Brander, who not only is one of the deans and vice presidents of this wonderful institution, has a unique smicha in infertility and halacha from a premier institute in Eretz Yisrael called PUA, in conjunction with Rabbi Dr. Zalman Levine, who is a musmach of this institution, who is practicing cutting-edge medicine at the forefront of infertility, all products of Yeshiva University, all trained within the halls of this institution. We should be extraordinarily proud of these kinds of events. We should continue these kinds of events. And I commend again the presidents of the Medical Ethics Society, starting from their young education, will continue this trend, Mirtz Hashem, for many, many more healthy years. We have spoken in the Medical Ethics Society about many esoteric topics, many important topics which address segments of the population, including, for example, organ donation, definition of death, things like that. But this session, I believe, has more relevance to more people than most of our sessions. And just to establish that relevance, I just want to ask you a question. Don't be bashful in responding. How many people in this audience actually have chromosomes? Anybody? Excellent, excellent. Okay, so I think we've established the relevance. How many people in this audience feel that their chromosomes are completely perfect and have no existing or predisposition to disease? What happened to all those hands? So there is a Maamar Chazal that says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu yistakel b'raiso bara alma, that God looked into the Sefer Torah, the Torah itself, and he created the world. I would submit that the converse is also true. Adam yistakel b'alma u'bara oraisa. So, which means that if man looks into the workings of the world, specifically into the genetic code, our human blueprint is the genetic code. God's blueprint is the Sefer Torah. Our blueprint is the human genome. If we study and understand the human genome, we will appreciate and understand the godless of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And as Rabbi Fold so eloquently said, based on this week's parsha of Virapo Yirape, God gave us the mandate. God told us, I gave you a complex world. I want you to understand that world. I want you to conquer that world. I want you to do what you can to heal as many people in this world. And in fact, some have even suggested that the very chromosomes themselves look like the Aleph Beis. And you have in the upper right-hand side of your handout a Aleph Beis chromosome font. You will look, and it's obviously written by somebody who wasn't Jewish because it goes from left to right as opposed from right to left. But if you look in the upper left-hand corner of that box, you'll see an Aleph chromosome followed by a Beis chromosome, a Gimel chromosome, a Dalet chromosome, a Hay chromosome. So obviously, you can accept this font, you can reject this font, but the concept is that we are the Torah is embedded into the human genome. And of course, if you think about it, there are some interesting parallels between the human genome and the Sefer Torah itself. They are both comprised of many letters in sequence. It is a code. It is a code that requires deciphering. And it is a code that if there is any abnormality in the code, there are problems. If there is a letter, one single letter missing in a Sefer Torah, or one single letter added in a Sefer Torah can be puzzled. If there is one single letter missing in the human genome, or one single letter added in the human genome, it can also create havoc. Wreak havoc on the human body, sometimes even cause death. Our objective today, of course, we will not be able to cover the totality of issues related to this exceedingly complex topic. We will touch on some of them. I think it is valuable simply to understand some of the basics of genetics, just to hear Dr. Agus and what she has to say, and to hear from Dr. Levine on the medical aspects are extremely essential in this particular area, because the medicine happens to be a little more complex than usual. And what I'd like to do is put this into the context of the history of halacha and the history of medicine for us today as well. So our first encounter, our first major encounter as a Jewish community with the world of modern genetics, as was alluded to by Dr. Agus, as we're not specifically going to talk about today, but we'll clearly allude to today, is the Tay-Sachs testing. Now, how many people in this room have seen a Tay-Sachs child? Handful of people go up. Now, if I would have asked this question 30 years ago, 40 years ago, how many hands would have gone up? Every single hand would have gone up. What has happened in these 40, 50 years? What has happened is what is beginning to happen now with the breast cancer gene. We understood the medicine and the science of Tay-Sachs disease. We began halachic discussions about Tay-Sachs disease, and we applied those halachic discussions to create a reality where Tay-Sachs is much, much, much less prevalent than it ever was in history. When we began these discussions about Tay-Sachs, the issues that we addressed were, first of all, the educational aspect is very similar. So people needed to be educated then, what is dominant gene, what is recessive gene, what is a carrier. We are beginning that dialogue now with the breast cancer gene, beginning by these kinds of discussions. Parenthetically, it is perhaps not coincidental that Tay-Sachs disease was the very first single gene disorder ever testable in the history of medicine, happens to be associated with the Jewish community. Breast cancer gene, a gene which is a predisposition gene, happens to be associated with the Jewish community. Some may call this coincidence. We, of course, don't believe there is any coincidence in these kinds of issues. But when we began the discussion with Tay-Sachs disease, what we discussed was the following. First of all, I turn your attention to the handout, to section 2, genetic testing, in the Hebrew handout. First, we began the discussion about whether we should test at all, which is part of our discussion today as well. And Rav Moshe Feinstein famously in his tshuva wrote, "Im yesh livdok l'machalat Tay-Sachs kodem hanisuin," should one perform premarital testing for Tay-Sachs? And his answer was, "Iyanti bazev ezehu anir eleni esdaiti, kiafshu miut katon yoladim noladim ka'elu," even though a small percentage of people are born with this condition, "b'shayach lomer el ze hanikra detomim hakra, detomim tiyayim Hashem elokecha," one could perhaps say, if God ordained this to happen, perhaps I should not intervene. Let me be simple and walk simply in the ways of God. But he rejected that. He said, "Mikol mokom kevon she'ata nasa ze be'ofen kalivdok," it is now easy to test. "Yesh lodun she'im eino bodek es atzmo hu kusagiras enayim liros ma she'efsho liros." One is closing one's eyes from what one can easily see. Keep that concern in mind as we discuss the issues today about breast cancer. So he, in fact, did clearly require people to test because it was testable and something could be prevented as a result. The next issue that he addressed and that others addressed was if one was found to be two members of the couple, both the husband and the wife, were found to be carriers, can they test their fetus? Is it permissible to test the fetus? And if you test the fetus and the fetus is determined to have Tay-Sachs disease, what can be done as a result? Can you perform an abortion? Can you not perform an abortion? Those were the major halachic issues of the last generation. And as we know, things have evolved over the last many years. And as a result of the marriage of halacha and medical science, we now come to the present reality where Tay-Sachs disease is almost non-existent. How have things developed now in the next generation? We now have the testing for a gene which is not as straightforward and not as simple as the Tay-Sachs equation. And that's the issue of the determination of the presence of a mutation in the BRCA gene. This is a predisposition gene, which means, as opposed to Tay-Sachs, if a child has genes of Tay-Sachs from both parents, that child, and it's a recessive gene, that child will have Tay-Sachs disease and with almost 100% mortality. This gene is conveyed by only one parent and not two. It is a dominant gene. And if someone has this gene, they have a predisposition to medical conditions, to specific cancers, both in the male and in the female. It does not mean that they will ever develop these conditions. They could potentially develop them and be cured. There are many, many more variables. So the question is, going back to the question posed to Moshe Feinstein Zatzal, should we be testing for this condition? Should we be testing for the BRCA gene? So here we need to engage in extensive discussions with our geneticists and with our scientists to understand what is the value of testing for this. In Tay-Sachs, it was clear you could prevent the birth of a child who would have a disease with almost 100% mortality. Here, it is a different story. Here, we are preventing ourselves from possibly developing a condition which is a very serious condition, which has mortality with it, but it's not 100% mortality. So the waters are a little less clear, and the discussions require much more analysis and much more dialogue, not only just between me and Dr. Agus, but between us and you, and between you amongst yourselves and amongst your families. Preventive medicine has generally been something which has been restricted to conditions like high blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes. We haven't really moved into the waters of prevention for something ambiguous as a predisposition gene. So we are all going through this new pathway, if you will, together. And while it is true that knowledge is power and knowledge can empower, and it is important to gain as much information as possible, I believe that the caveat for that principle is knowledge is power only if you are powerful with that knowledge to do something. If you can't act on that knowledge, then there's no use for that knowledge. And one area that you can clearly act is in the testing for this breast cancer gene. We'll discuss in our next section briefly, after Nicole discusses some of the science, about prevention. And just one last comment before I hand it over to Nicole. And this really applies to basically every scientific and medical session we're going to have in the foreseeable future. We live in an age where we acquire knowledge in an exponentially greater pace than we have ever done in the history of mankind. That is an extraordinary thing, and it's a curse. So we gain so much knowledge and so rapidly that literally you will have an advance or a discovery across the world, and it'll be a Twitter feed or a text on your phone within minutes of the discovery. The problem is, while you may know of that discovery in minutes, it can take decades before we understand the clinical relevance and application of that discovery. So we are living in a continual chasm. We are living in this situation where we're gaining an immense amount of knowledge, but we don't know yet the significance of much of the knowledge that we are gaining. Yet, we have to make decisions today. You have to make decisions for yourselves, for your families. Rabbis have to make decisions. So we have, and there is a principle of Ein L'Dayan, Elamasha Ein Avros. The Dayan can only know what is knowable at the particular time. So we will make these decisions today with the knowledge that we have to the best of our ability, knowing fully well that in 10 years, 20 years hence, these decisions will be very, very different, and the issues will be very, very different. So having said that, we'll pass over to Dr. Agus, and we'll continue for the next section.
All right, so we're going to move on now to the issue number two, which is options for BRCA carriers. So we're going to make the assumption that people have gone to get testing. They've thought about it. They've talked to their family members. Sometimes they've also talked to their postdoc about it, and they've decided that going to a genetic counselor to speak about genetic testing is the right thing for them to do. They go to a genetic counselor, they hear the options and limitations of testing, they get tested, they come back, they're BRCA carriers. What can they do now? They go back to the genetic counselor and they talk about their options. And there are multiple options. And the options doesn't mean that you always need to take the most severe route with those options. So one of the options is increased surveillance. And this would apply to men and women who are come back to be BRCA carriers. They can go for more extensive screening. They can go for more frequent screening so that if there is a cancer that's going to develop, they could actually pick up those cancers at a much earlier and more treatable stage. So people will choose that, increased surveillance, more extensive screening. But then we have a problem for cancers like ovarian cancer. Ovarian cancer is also known as the silent killer because the screening that we have now for ovarian cancer is not effective. So we can try to screen for it, but it really won't pick up most of the cases. And when cases are picked up, they're at a very late and untreatable stage. So what can we do for ovarian cancer? We can do preventive prophylactic surgery, meaning you can do a surgery before a cancer would ever develop to take out the ovaries and the fallopian tubes. It's called BSO surgery. And this is extremely effective in eliminating almost entirely the chance of getting an ovarian cancer, and also helps to prevent the breast cancer risk. So it's a very effective method to do this prophylactic preventive surgery. But the problem is it's a complicated surgery, and also if you do this, this will render the woman infertile and also bring on early menopause. So it's very loaded. When someone chooses this technology, there are a lot of decisions that have to be made and different complications that have to be thought out. And this is much more loaded than the preventive surgery that you would do to prevent breast cancer, which would be to get a bilateral mastectomy in the case of BRCA. And that is a little less complicated because you don't have the issues in infertility and menopause. So I'm going to let Dr. Reifman cover some of this halachic medical perspective on this issue, and then we'll talk about the next generation.
So our issue presently is you have tested for this gene and you have found to be positive for the gene. Now there's BRCA1, there's BRCA2, there's many differences in terms of percentages of the risk for breast cancer and ovarian cancer. We'll leave those to the geneticists and to the clinicians to sift out. What I'd like to do in this section is to address what the halachic ramifications are for these kinds of things. First of all, again, how things have changed in terms of the discussions. So for the Tay-Sachs gene, the issue was premarital testing to prevent the propagation of that gene. And the issue was potential testing in utero and consideration of abortion if a child was found to be positive for Tay-Sachs. So the abortion issue is not a discussion in the BRCA gene. There is not one single POSEC and not one single person that would say, if you're found as a husband or a wife to be positive for the BRCA gene and you're having children and you've already conceived and you have a child in utero, that you should test that child in utero to find out if they're positive for the BRCA gene, and if they are, consider abortion. That is simply not even on the table. We're not talking about issues of abortion. No one would consider such a thing, as that child could be born healthy, 100% healthy, and have an entirely healthy life. So where is our focus then? Our focus is on the individual, if they are tested positive, what they can do to prevent the development of cancer for themselves. Now, Dr. Eggs mentioned surveillance. Surveillance is clearly in the ambit of requirement, according to in the world of halacha. And our obligation for self-preservation, just as we would be required to monitor our blood pressure, monitor our blood sugar, to make sure we are healthy. This is mandated by all. The Rambam doesn't only mention it in his medical works, the Rambam mentions it in his halachic works, how it is essential for us to maintain our health in order to be able to continue our worship, to continue our avodas Hashem. So knowing that you are BRCA positive, you clearly have an obligation of increased surveillance. How that surveillance will manifest itself, that's going to require medical discussion. What's the most effective way for surveillance? Is it mammograms starting at a certain age? Is it just what type of radiological mammograms? Is it X-ray? Is it ultrasound? Is it MRI? All those kinds of issues, those we need to follow the medical guidance as they evolve. Other forms of prevention could, moving a step up from just simply surveillance, include the possibility of taking medications, some hormonal medications which might be proven to prevent the development of certain cancers. Those require a slightly different analysis because medications might be associated with certain risks. But on balance, clearly there is great benefit to taking medication if the scientists believe that the medication could indeed prevent you from developing the cancer. But we are now moving into a territory which is uncharted waters. And that's the notion of doing surgery to prevent the development of disease. So we've had medications to prevent the development of disease, vaccinations, which is a whole other major issue and probably requires another session from the Medical Ethics Society about the recent outbreak of measles and the Jewish perspective on vaccination, which needs to be reiterated. But the concept of actually performing surgery to surgically remove parts of the body that don't have cancer, may never have cancer, but to prevent us from the possibility of developing cancer, that's a new frontier. Medicine hasn't gone there before, and we're now beginning to develop an analysis of how this should work. Now, there's a very important difference between the prevention, the surgical prevention for breast cancer and the surgical prevention for ovarian cancer. Surgical prevention for breast cancer has the classic halachic issues that relate to any surgical procedure. It is a chavalah, it is a wounding, it is a risky procedure. And in addition to that, there's the psychological dimension of undergoing bilateral mastectomy and that impact. But these are issues which, I won't say they're minor issues, they're definitely important issues, but on balance, one could make a strong case, and poskim have pasked in this way, that it is clearly permissible for a woman to undergo a bilateral mastectomy if, indeed, that is something which the scientists believe would prevent the disease. I'm not sure we're at a stage, Dr. Agus, where bilateral mastectomy is necessarily better than heightened surveillance. People have a choice, exactly. But whereas surveillance might be obligatory from a halachic perspective, surgical procedures cannot be obligatory. You cannot force someone to undergo a major surgical procedure involving anesthesia, involving cutting parts of the body in order to prevent the disease. It's a decision. decision that the individual would have to make. But what about for ovarian cancer? For ovarian cancer, the issues are different and much more serious, because once you remove the ovarian tissue, you can't have a child. So here you introduce the whole topic of pru revu, of the obligation to be fruitful and multiply. So if you remove the ovary, so for example, if you have a single woman who finds out that she's positive for the BRCA gene, unmarried, should she remove her ovaries before she gets married, before she has a child? So the answer to that is not so simple. It is not clearly understood yet scientifically at what age is the best age for the ovaries to be removed. It is clearly preferable, and we obviously, as many people in this audience know, we are not obligated, the woman is not obligated in pru revu, yet she is a major factor in the facilitation of pru revu. So clearly, while she may not be obligatory to be the filaments of pru revu, she would clearly want to, and her spouse would want to. So when this would happen and when this would not happen is an interesting issue. Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you turn to your handout page, I think it's probably the last page of your handout, on prophylactic surgery, he actually addressed an interesting issue. This is a number of decades ago, but relevant even to our discussion today, of a woman who underwent a removal of her womb, a hysterectomy for a medical purpose, and the physicians wanted to, while they were operating on her and already inside the abdominal cavity, remove the ovarian tissue as well because of the risk of ovarian cancer. And the risk, if you look in the highlight section and the bolded section rather, afim neima de'ein la'asos mitchila nituach bishvil chashash de'echad me'esrim mishum shigam ha'nituach ba'atzmo nami bazeh chashash sakana. So he said if the risk was just 1 in 20 that she would develop the condition, Rav Moshe said he would not have necessarily considered the permissibility of doing that surgery just for that purpose alone. But since you're already operating in the OR, already taking out the uterus, you should take out the ovaries for that potential risk of cancer. Without going into the details of his particular analysis, this is clearly an important issue of ovarian removal. Let me just add, there's a few other interesting dimensions here. Whereas Rav Moshe Feinstein's analysis was a woman undergoing hysterectomy, and then you would consider removing the ovaries in addition, there could be an interesting flip of that in the 21st century, just to move us even more forward thinking, that if a woman is undergoing removal of her ovaries, for example, positivity of breast cancer of the BRCA1, BRCA2 gene, would we consider allowing her to remove her uterus for the possibility of donating that uterus for a uterus transplant, which has now been performed in a number of places in the world, a topic which we will probably address in the Medical Ethics Society in the very near future about the halachic ramifications of the uterus, of uterus transplants, and who's considered the halachic mother in such scenarios, and Pidyon HaBen for such scenarios. But finally, before we move to back to Nicole, another very important option, which Rabbi Dr. Levine, I don't know if he'll address this specific issue in his discussion with Rabbi Brander, is that if you're doing ovarian removal for this possibility of breast cancer, it doesn't necessarily mean that the woman could never have her own genetic child, because it's possible to freeze ovarian tissue or eggs from women who are undergoing the prophylactic surgery so they could subsequently have their own children, genetic children. So that's a very, very important medical option. Should I speak about PGD now or PGD afterwards? So maybe allow me a few moments of another option. In terms of prevention, not only for you, but for your future progeny, and especially since we have the luxury of having Rabbi Fold with us today, who is responsible for one of the world's premier PGD labs in Eretz Yisrael at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, which is performing these procedures on a routine basis. How many people in this audience are familiar with the three letters PGD? Okay, fairly high number. I will obviously discuss very briefly what that means. This is a three letters which, just like some of these other questions that I've asked you, in 5-10 years from now, everyone will be familiar with PGD. It'll be much more common. But it stands for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which briefly means it is possible to fertilize an egg in the laboratory with the sperm and the egg of the husband and wife, and to test that for everything that is known genetically at the time that you are doing the testing, and to act accordingly in terms of which type of embryos you'd like to implant. It can be used to prevent Tay-Sachs disease. It can be used to determine gender of a child. It can be used to produce a child who can serve as a bone marrow donor to an existing child who has a malignancy. Many, many options. One of the options that it is being used for, as Rabbi Fulda told us in the beginning, is to prevent the development of a child with the breast cancer gene. Now, as he alluded to, it is a little different to do PGD for Tay-Sachs than to do for the breast cancer gene, because a Tay-Sachs child has 100% mortality close to it, but a child who has the BRCA gene could grow up healthy and contribute to society in many other ways. So while it is an extraordinary option and an option which many people can take, it is not necessarily a requirement to perform PGD to prevent the next generation from developing this condition. And it is possible, as Roy Fuld himself mentioned, that in 20, 30, 40 years from now, we will have other ways to treat the breast cancer gene. But just a tantalizing thought experiment before I transfer back to Nicole. If, for example, everybody in this generation that was positive for the BRCA gene availed themselves of PGD and utilized PGD to produce children that didn't have the BRCA gene, in theory, we could eliminate that gene in one generation. I'm not saying advocating this necessarily, but it is just a provocative thought.
All right, so I think that we covered PGD pretty well with Rabbi Fuld's introductory remarks and also with Rabbi Reichman. But if anyone wants to learn more about PGD, on our online education program, which is called MyJewishGeneticHealth.com, there's a specific lesson on PGD, and you can actually see how the technology works. There's video from the lab, and you can hear some of the halachic and medical and ethical implications. So it's a really cool video to watch if you're interested further. But I think the most important thing here is that if you have a family where you have the father or the mother being a BRCA carrier, and you know this before a pregnancy, you can use in vitro fertilization with PGD to actually prevent the implantation of an embryo that is a BRCA carrier as well. So you're essentially protecting that child from the risk, and then also the whole line that will ultimately develop from that child. So like Dr. Reichman said, you are actually stopping this in that generation, and not just for the sake of that one child, but for all of their future generations too. So it's still not as popular as using PGD for things like cystic fibrosis or for Tay-Sachs, for diseases like those diseases. And in fact, we've just done a survey of about 300 medical professionals to see if they would consider recommending PGD for a problem like a BRCA mutation. And they're really split between strongly agree, disagree, and that's not the case for a disease like Tay-Sachs. So I think it's still going to take a while for the medical community to wake up and see that this is also a very powerful option and is something that we can do to eliminate the risk. Okay, so I think I'm going to move on to the third issue now, which is the issue of disclosure. And the question is, what happens when someone finds out that they are a BRCA carrier? So who should they tell? Who do they need to tell? The first level is blood relatives, because if someone's found to be a BRCA carrier, that means that one of their parents is most likely a BRCA carrier as well. It means that some of their siblings may be BRCA carriers. It means that other blood relatives may be BRCA carriers. And if they found out their status and have the options available to them, they should also be informing their relatives about the fact that they have this, and their relatives can make the choice about whether or not they want to get tested and what the options would be for them. So in the medical field, it is extremely advisable to tell your blood relatives if you find out that you are a BRCA carrier. And we've had really beautiful examples of people coming to us, finding out, and then telling their family just in time. We've also had examples of people who want to tell their family but are very scared to tell their family and don't have the mechanism or the emotional presence to do so, and we can help them tell their families. So that's one level of disclosure to blood relatives who also may be affected and may be BRCA carriers. The next level is to one's children. So when do you tell your child that you may be a BRCA carrier or that you are a BRCA carrier? And that's really, really complex, not only when to tell them, but how to tell your children. And a very important take-home message for today is that in the medical community, BRCA testing is not advised for people under the age of 25. So the reason for that is that until you're 25, there's not really much you're going to do with somebody who's a BRCA carrier. You're not going to start surveillance so early. You're not going to start these prophylactic surgeries. So we say that around 25 is when you can start considering testing. So the younger people are not being tested, so you don't need to tell your kids at a very early stage. I think the last section of disclosure relates to whether you need to disclose this to a potential spouse or to a matchmaker. And I think I'm going to pass that over because this is really charged. And do you reveal BRCA status to a potential spouse? So I'll let Rabbi Dr. Reichman deal with that one.
The element of disclosure merits its own full analysis. And as luck would have it, just a few weeks ago at this very podium, Rabbi Daniel Feldman spent an hour on this entire issue of the requirement of disclosure in both in Shiduchim and in other areas. In this particular area, it's different than an individual having a condition that they would disclose to a spouse. It's an individual having a condition, the information of which could help save the life of somebody else. So it's an interplay not just of the laws of Lashon Hara and disclosing information about somebody else. It's also involved the laws of Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa, don't stand by as someone else could potentially be harmed in the absence of that information. And clearly the laws of Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa apply here. However, as we have said in this particular discussion, what complicates matters is that there is no guarantee that any other of your family members even have this condition. Some may not, as opposed to some other conditions. So that factor of the statistical probability weighs in on your requirement to disclose this information. So if you know you have information which could definitely harm someone, then you are absolutely required to disclose. If you have information that may or may not harm them, so it's only a 50% chance that any of your siblings may have this condition, then it may not rise to the level of required disclosure. Even in terms of shiduchim, so all the discussions about shiduchim that date back to the for thousands of years of discussions, and in the last 200 years there have been much halachic literature. And the Chafetz Chaim has very clear parameters about what can be disclosed. His parameters are, you have to know for certain that the individual has a particular condition. You have to know for certain that condition is harmful. You have to do it without malice to disclose the information, a whole litany of requirements. But the number one requirement for required disclosure is you have to know that the individual has this condition. So if you have someone who is carrying the breast cancer gene, for example, both for themselves and for others, it is not 100%. Just because you have the gene does not mean 100% you'll develop the condition. So it may not technically rise to the level of required disclosure, both in terms of shiduchim and in terms of Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa. However, having said that, and by the way, this should be discussed with a POSEC on a case-by-case basis. Having said that, strongly suggested disclosure, it definitely meets that criterion. There's no question today in this age of information where everybody, all this information is readily known and knowable, and people know that you've known this information and not disclosed it to them, it could lead to tremendous ill will within families and between potential spouses. When to disclose this is a major aspect of the discussion. when in shidduchim to disclose this, when a spouse should disclose, when during dating people should disclose. That requires a lengthy analysis, not just with us, with myself and with Dr. Agus, but with the psychologists and people who understand relationships. And YU has had many of these discussions, and those discussions will continue as well. But I suggest you should listen to Rabbi Feldman's talk from a few weeks ago from this very podium, where he covered in a lengthy halachic analysis many of these issues.
All right, so we're really running out of time, so I'm going to bring up the last issue very quickly, and this is the most emotionally and ethically charged issue, but I'll just throw it out there, and then we can discuss it more in the questions and answers, or you're welcome to contact our program and talk to us more. So in figure three, we talked about the 1 in 40 carrier rate for an Ashkenazi Jewish person, to male or female, to be having one of these three BRCA mutations. And the question that is now out there is whether all Ashkenazi individuals should be tested for BRCA status, regardless of whether they have had or have cancer, regardless if they have strong family histories. So just by virtue of someone being Ashkenazi Jewish, because the carrier rate is this 1 in 40 number, which is a very big number, should everyone go out and get tested? And this is really controversial and charged, but this is what's the heat of the moment now. It's been covered in the New York Times, and there were studies that came out of Israel from Dr. Efrat Levi-Lahad that actually suggest that whether or not you have a very strong family history, there's still this 1 in 40 carrier rate, and you still are at the very similar risk to develop these cancers. So if we know we can test for this and we know that the options are really good, should we all be going out to get tested? And we're not ready to sanction that yet. And we are not sanctioning that because it's a very complicated decision and something that requires a lot of thought and energy. But I have to tell you, in full disclosure, our program has just rolled out a testing initiative for BRCA. People who want to know their status can come to our program and can be directed either to the traditional genetic counseling route if they're from a high-risk family, or they can come to our new route, which is a subsidized way to get testing for BRCA status if you just want to know. And there are people out there who really want to know. There are people who are very scared to get the information and are not ready to get the information yet, but there are people who really want to know because they know that the knowledge is power. The testing can identify carriers who would otherwise have gone undetected, and it can save lives. So we have this option now, but again, we don't sanction it for everyone. We don't want everyone in this audience or everywhere running to us and saying, I need to get tested now, because it's something that requires thought. Again, BRCA status, if you're a carrier, does not mean that it's a guarantee you will develop cancer. There are a lot of other elements, and there are a lot of halachic, ethical, and psychological conversations that need to be had before you run out and get this testing. So I think we'll close on that, and if there are a few questions, maybe we have time for a few questions.
This is just a very brief comment. It must have been at least 30 years ago when this all, the Tay-Sachs testing got going. And my parents were long past the age of childbearing. We were all young adults or middle-aged adults or whatever. And they went and got themselves tested because they wanted us to know what the story was with us. So it's a great idea.
Yeah, we have a lot of fathers who are coming in now to get tested for their daughters. Like they want their, but also for their sons. They should think about their sons too, but they want to know so that they can then inform their daughters and sons so that they can take the options that we discussed today.
Yeah, just a couple of comments. The first is, I'm a surgical oncologist. I practice in New Jersey. And when you're testing somebody for BRCA, I think it's always best to test somebody in the family who's actually had the disease, if there's one available and is willing to be tested. Because a negative test, as we all know, doesn't mean that there aren't any other genes in the family that might not necessarily be problematic. The second is the difference between enhanced surveillance and surgical prophylaxis. Enhanced surveillance, at best, picks up a cancer when it's already developed, and potentially, even at the earliest stage, may have the potential to metastasize and cause significant harm. Prophylaxis reduces the risk down to probably about 3 to 5% from 50 to 80%. It's never 100%, but it reduces it dramatically and eliminates that thought and the every 6 month coming back and the anxiety over the testing, which is a really significant part of the practice as well.
Thank you.
going to be the last question.
Two questions, but I'll make them quick. My wife has BRCA2 and she had breast removal. She advised our daughter. Do we have to advise the granddaughter? I mean, do you have to test the third generation? That's number one. Number two, should the sons also be tested or just the daughters?
So with respect to question number two, the sons should also be tested if they want to be tested, because just like the daughters, they have a 50% chance of inheriting the mutation from the grandmother. And if the daughters prove to be positive and they have undergone testing, then their children are also at risk to be cancer. So at the right time, you know, not before 25, but at the right time, they should also consider testing. I think that was the last question, but I'll stay around. So thank you very much.